This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You're listening to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Ho-Ho-Loo Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Juden are the hard-traveling fanboys.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Hard Traveling Fanboys Studio in Ho-Ho-Loon Plaza, in full and serene Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as he is every week here in the studio, is Nick Duke. And we are here to bring you a much welcomed new edition of Countdown.
Mm-hmm.
Been a while, Nick, since we've done a countdown.
Yep, it's the it has been quite some time, and here we are back again, finally, to hit people with it. And this is one that we've kind of kicked down the road a couple of times, and let's see how it turns out. I don't know.
I think in the background you can actually hear me kicking that can down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So for those that don't know, of course, is our monthly, usually monthly, depends on if we're doing a theme month or not, look at the at a list, basically. It's our version of the modern internet journalism, just making lists of things. Mm-hmm. And so it might be our favorites.
Yeah, we're gonna update this theme pretty soon here, and Countdown will become five things we love and four things we don't about a given topic.
That's right. And then maybe we'll do the top 11 reasons why you have to read a comic book.
Right.
And the 10 reasons you don't. this month we're going to take in things that we don't like, actually. Because this month we are counting down what we consider to be the five worst character changes in all of comics. Now, this covers a lot of ground, and obviously we're biased towards things that have happened in our readership. So almost all of this stuff, I can't speak for Nick's list, but all of my stuff's going to be modern age, so 80s and afterwards. And that's not to say that there weren't terrible character changes from the 40s on, but we're kind of focusing in on the ones that we've read about and the ones that we've experienced and the ones that just got our blood boiling. Not that it's natural to be angry about a fictional character, but these are the changes that either made us shake our heads, react with anger and vitriol, go online and complain about things, whatever it may be. These are the changes that we feel like ruined characters or took the characters in directions from which it was difficult to recover or took a long time to recover, or just absolute boneheaded, head-scratching decisions, such as going for a fake field goal from 8 yards out that involves your third-string quarterback trying to run. Just decisions that leave you puzzled and scratching your head. So we're going to kick it off, and I'm going to let Nick start off this time around. Nick, give us your number five.
All right, so this is the one that I feel like is kind of testing the boundaries of this, because it isn't really a change to an established character, but it's one that I've talked about before on this show and other places. I am going to go somewhat controversially and use a character here, and my argument here is that the change was from the original version of the character, and he was then filtered through the lens of the Ultimate Universe, and it was terrible. And of course, I am referring to Ultimate Cable. I am no fan of 616 Cable. I am no X-Men aficionado the way you and Tim Cable and the esteemed Jeremy Reynolds are. So I have no great good feelings towards Cable. I have no real attachment to the character. But I know he's a cool-looking character. I always liked when he popped up in the animated series. And so when the time came for him to pop up in the pages of Ultimate X-Men, I was like, oh, this might be pretty cool. And the first issue, he's running around, he's hunting the X-Men, he's doing badass things. Everything's going well. I'm like, oh, this is going to be good. And then at the end of the issue, we get the big reveal that Cable is actually Ultimate Wolverine. Now, you may be asking yourself, why would Wolverine have a metal arm? Well, you see, in the Ultimate Universe, Apocalypse can steal other mutants' powers. And so he stole the future version of Wolverine's healing factor and then ripped his arm off. And because he didn't have a healing factor anymore, the arm didn't grow back, so he had a metal arm. And then later on, Apocalypse used Wolverine's own arm to scratch his face, to scar his face. That's where he gets the fingers that Cable is known for as well. And no healing factor, of course. And then he decides he's going to go back in time, and somehow if he kills Charles Xavier before anything ever happens, Apocalypse will never show up, and he'll never get his arm ripped off, and everything will just be all fine and hunky-dory. But, yeah, man, this whole reveal of, like, Cable as just another version of Wolverine, so eye-rolling, so fan-fiction-y to me. The X-Men comics, especially in modern days, have already been criticized for being a little too Wolverine-centric, and this was just another bun, so to speak. Not a good character change. Not a good character change at all. The motivation never really made sense. And, I mean, he turned Wolverine into Cable. He's already Wolverine. Just have him be Wolverine. Made no sense to me. It was very lame. One of the worst moments in all of Ultimate X-Men.
Well, Wolverine or Marvel has a real problem with just letting Wolverine be Wolverine, as you know, Nick. So that's too simple for them. So choice here. I've not read the Ultimate Universe that extensively, but I have been told by you that I would particularly hate that reveal whenever I came across it. And one day, perhaps I might be cajoled into doing a long book hunt on that particular volume of Ultimate X-Men. We'll have to.
Robert Kirkman, Ultimate X-Men is not a thing God. I wish upon my worst enemies.
Oh, Lord. I'm sure the dialogue is actually. Now, who is the good man of that? Is it Cyclops?
I believe it's Xavier, actually.
Xavier's a good man and a great man.
But he has to die.
Oh, good Lord. Nevertheless, we endure. On my list at number 5, I'm going to kick things off with the first but not the last appearance of a little initiative we know as the New 52, Nick.
Oh, boy, here we go.
Now, this one, in fairness, came a couple years after the New started. This actually occurred, I believe, in 2014, if I'm not way off on my timeline here. But actually, I take that. No, yeah. I think that's right. And so I'm trying to think of a way to properly explain this. So in the 90s, one of the most popular, not just in DC, but in all of comics, was The Last Zarnian, the Fraggin' Bastich, the main man, Lobo.
Ah, yes.
He was known as the ultimate stereotype of 90s comic book excess. In fact, he was envisioned as a parody of the Wolverine archetype, the Cable archetype, big guns, big hair, face paint, red eyes, drives a motorcycle through space, chains and leather everywhere, talks in cliches and catchphrases, is completely over the top and hilarious. Intentionally so. This was the idea here. He becomes one of DC's most popular characters in that decade. Fast forward to the 2000s, Lobo's popularity had died out significantly from its peak. Still a fairly popular character to pop in time. But everybody knows him. He's been in animation. He's been in all the Justice League shows. He's popped up in other animated series over the years. Batman, Brave and the Bold, etc. And people know who Lobo is. He's comedy relief. He shows up. He literally murdered his entire race of people, and that's why he's the last Zarnian.
Well, not if you believe the New 52 version.
That's right. Because the New 52 decided at a certain point – well, first of all, they introduced two new versions of Lobo, because when the New 52 started, Lobo was a Zarnian slaver who had killed the rest of his race except for his beloved Princess Sheba. that in and of itself is completely ass backwards. That was Rob Liefeld's idea. Surely it can't get any worse, right? Just keep Lobo Lobo. Well, instead, 2014 comes around and Cullen Bunn and some artist, I don't even know who the artist, get the opportunity to redesign Lobo. I think it was Kenneth Rockefort, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. Get a chance to redesign Lobo for the New 52 and introduce a new version that they claim to be the real Lobo. And he's a, what they described, a rockabilly-influenced version of Lobo. He's sleek and he's slender. They took all the muscles away from Lobo and made him a slender, smooth-looking character. They gave him what I can best describe as 50s Elvis hair. They smoothed out his – they made him look a lot less like Gene Simmons and a lot more like, I don't know, Ricky Martin or some pop singer. So he's thinner. He's slimmer. Also, and I'm going to read this from the Wikipedia entry for Lobo. Cultured and well-educated, although ruthless, this Lobo is an mercenary and bounty hunter with a leaner physique. This new version sets course for Earth after discovering his counterpart, a Zarnian imposter, this of course being the Lobo that we had known for years, had been there. According to this version's backstory, Lobo was originally the body Zarnian royal family who utilized a Eucharist-like ritual involving the planet's lifeblood, pools similar to the Lazarus pits. Drinking or bathing in these pools granted participants regenerative ability, giving them to the Emperor and the Emperor himself to the entire planet. However, some unknown party contaminated the lifeblood, causing the Zarnian Empire and citizenry to go insane, which in turn forced Lobo to commit planetary euthanasia. So suddenly you've taken Lobo being a crazed madman who killed his entire planet to actually he's a hero who's saved them from a life of madness. It was a horrific idea. Needless to say, the internet comic book community is already resistant to any kind of change, but this change went over like a fart in church, or rather like multiple farts in church.
Fart in church.
And people instantly reacted negatively to this. Nonetheless, they persevered. They launched a Lobo solo series, and they tried to make him a little more rough around the edges in it, but people had already made up their minds, including myself, after I read the debut of this Lobo character, which was written by Marguerite Bennett, actually. I said Cullen Bunn, but Marguerite Bennett actually wrote the one shot that launched it. And it's to this day, Nick, and I think I mentioned this to you on the show once before during a countdown, to this day it's one of the worst single-issue comics that I've read. One of those comics made me facepalm and roll my eyes in a way that I rarely do reading. Because I give a pretty wide berth to comics in terms of the writing and the craftsmanship of the comics, but this was just it sucked.
It's the comics version of if you remember, Greg. Rumor was they were going to do the gritty urban reboot of Commando, and it was going to take it ultra seriously. This is the comics version of that to me.
Yep,
except it actually happened.
Yeah. So did you read or encounter this version of Lobo at all?
No, I don't believe so. I do remember his catchphrase though. Do you remember that?
Sorry, not sorry.
Sorry, not sorry. Yep.
I remember that because the writer chose to use that catchphrase no fewer than three or four times throughout the no fewer than three times, but it probably as many as five or six times throughout the course of that one issue.
Yes. And then, of course, I most fondly remember the character for with in the Rebirth era with being an item in Larfleeze's collection, and Guy Gardner prevents anybody from releasing it.
Yeah, with the line being actually best just to keep him on the shelf. I love this story has a happy ending, ladies and gentlemen, because that new 52 version of Lobo was quietly pushed aside and replaced with the original pre-new 52 version of Lobo. And say the only mention of that old, that other Lobo has been that one reference in Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps.
Yes, that is accurate. So I guess we'll move on to my number four, unless you have more to say on
Lobo.
And here's one that, you know, when I was sitting down to make my list, I somehow almost blanked completely on this particular entry, and I don't know how, because it's one of my most hated things of all time. I'm actually a little surprised that it only falls at number 4 on my list, but here we go. For me, I'm going to go back to the late 80s slash early 90s in the Marvel Universe, and I am going to say that one of my one of the worst character changes for me ever in the history of comics, and argued there on my list now that I think about it. Let's talk about Eric Masterson.
Oh.
Now, Greg, you go ahead and give your interpretation of how that name should be pronounced, please.
Eric Masterson.
Only
Throw
funny.
It down.
Only funny to us.
Or for that might be funny to maybe three other people in the world, Eric Masterson.
Eric Masterson. So, Eric Masterson was a a Norwegian architect, I believe, who somehow befriended Thor and went on adventures with him a couple of times. And when he was accidentally mortally wounded while in action, Thor made the unique choice to bond with him, to bond his human, his godly form with a human, much like he had once done for the lame Dr. Donald Blake. And they did this once as a one-off in the Thor comics, and then they kind of undid it, then they redid it, and they kept teasing this idea of returning to the earthly identity for Thor, giving him a split personality again, forgetting that arguably one of the least interesting things about Thor in his early years was the Donald Blake thing. And it wasn't because of Donald Blake, it was because nobody wants to see Thor just walking around like a normal dude. Not every character needs a secret identity. You could argue that the lack of a secret identity to differentiate Thor from the rest of the Marvel Universe and set him apart during his most iconic runs under Walt Simonson and in the modern era under Jason Aaron. But I digress. In any event, they eventually go ahead and permanent Eric Masterson and Thor one individual. And this causes Eric Masterson to have to give up custody of his son because he realizes that his life as Thor will be
give
too
me
dangerous.
Back my son!
Even if he's Thor all the time, he can protect his son, no problem. Whatever. But the main problem is that, much like Donald Blake, Eric Masterson was just a lame character. Like, they attempted to give him a little bit of pathos with the sun angle, but by taking the sun off the board so quickly, they never really explored that. And it became this dead weight around the character, this anchor tied to the ass of Thor, essentially, where we had to carry around a lame alter ego for what felt – it was only a year, but it felt like 10, for God's sake. And so eventually –
there is an anchor tied to your ass, and his name is Eric Masterson.
And what made it worse is eventually they decided they were going to bring back the original – or they were going to kill off the original Thor. They killed off Thor. And so they had Eric Masterson just become like the new Thor. They actually called him that, the new Thor, there for a little while, even though the other Thor was dead and he didn't really look any differently than the old Thor. He just acted differently and had to pretend to use Shakespearean dialogue, basically fake it as an Asgardian and whatnot. It was just awful. And then eventually – when they brought Thor back, they decided that there was such a great need to keep Eric Masterson around, they were going to give him the identity of Thunderstrike. And what differentiates Thunderstrike from Thor, you may ask? Well, Strike was Thor, who looked the same and acted the same, but carried an axe and wasn't as powerful and basically was really lame. That was the difference between Thor and Thunderstrike. So,
lame Thunderstrike?
What?
I said the lame Thunderstrike?
The lame Thunderstrike. Not the ultimate male Thunderstrike, unfortunately.
Oh.
This was all terrible. It eventually culminated in Eric Masterson being killed by Blood Axe. Blood Axe was a... yes.
That's the most 90s name.
Yes, Blood Axe, who eventually was revealed to be his girlfriend, Jackie Lucas. Somehow that made sense. Anyway, he was eventually killed, and the way he was killed is that
Blood Axe.
He had to fight. You know, he'd already killed Blood Axe, but he was worried that the curse of the Blood Axe, which was an item as well as the thing's name, was going to take over. It was going to take him over and drive him insane and make him kill people. And so he would kill him to prevent the curse of the Blood Axe from taking him over. But what happened was he had to fight Blood Axe inside his own mind. And when he defeated Blood Axe inside his own... Fuck the Eric Masterson. He's Hulk Hogan. Well, you know the rest.
Who should play Eric Masterson in the MCU whenever they introduce him? Dolph Lundgren, maybe?
Shia LaBeouf.
Shia LaBeouf, the replacement Thor, Eric Masterson. Mm-hmm. I like it. Well, that all sounds terrible, Nick. And very '90s. So I kind of want to read it because it sounds like it's just an encapsulation of.
That's the thing, though, is it never really embraced that '90s form of storytelling. So it's not even bad entertaining. It's boring entertaining. Boring bad, not entertaining bad. Excuse me.
But I mean, it's just that, you know, the.
We have to change everything for the sake of changing.
Yes, and give him a cool, like, you know, a bloodier weapon, and give him, like, I bet he had some sort of pads on at some point in the 90s, mm-hmm. a leather jacket maybe. That's talking about. Well, while we're talking about characters impersonating other characters, Nick, I also am going to turn to Marvel Comics for this, and you'll have to bear with me for a minute because that history you just gave me on Thunderstrike, I've got a little history lesson for you that's going to be mostly new information for you. Because mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you the tale of a character named Zorn. Mm-hmm. So buckle up, sir. This one will get weird. Okay, so this goes back to Grant Morrison's long tenure on – or not only that long tenure – on New X-Men. This was – Morrison, along with Frank Quitely and several other artists, kind of, in a way, doing a soft X-Men, taking over the franchise and taking it in a bold new direction, and a direction that largely, depending on who you're talking to, worked. Some people didn't like it. Some people did like it. I actually really liked it. I read it in a trade form at the library during the book Exodus, and I enjoyed it a lot, actually. But he did a lot of bold things, a lot of crazy things. Well, in the midst of this run, there's a new character that's introduced. His name is Zorn, X-O-R-N. And he's introduced as a Chinese mutant who has a white star where his head should be. So he has to wear a protective helmet at all times. He can never take it off.
Wait a minute. So where's his brain?
Inside the white star.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll take your word.
Zorn was held captive by the Chinese government and attempted suicide by removing his mask, but that would have also destroyed the world because it would have unleashed this star. He was talked down by Emma Fufford, a place in the X-Men. Turns out that he was a healer. He goes around and he heals several people around the mansion, including Xavier. He heals his paralysis, allows the Professor X to start walking again in the mansion. This is one of the major changes that they introduced, the creative team. Even took over the quote, special class of students at Xavier School, and was a generally well-regarded member of the team, albeit he had a penchant for long speeches. Then came a truly fantastic shock twist that is one of those great comic book twists that actually works. And what happened was, at the time this new X-Men run was going on, Magneto was believed to be dead, killed during Cassandra Nova's attack on Genosha, which I barely remember that part of the story. But it was a big, big story. Everybody thought Magneto was dead. Well, turns out Zorn finally takes off mask, and there's no star there at all. It was Magneto the entire time. He had constructed an elaborate ruse with the help of Chinese officials and various other contacts, faked every part of Zorn's backstory to gain access to the X-Men, and he instantly paralyzes Professor X again, destroys most of New York City, or much of it, and aims to destroy the human population of Earth. And as a result, or not as a result, but the reason for all this is that Magneto has become addicted to this manipulative drug called Kick, that mutants are hooked on around the world, that enhances your abilities. It puts you on steroids, but it also affects your mindset and everything. It's truly like a mutant street drug. And Magneto has become addicted to this, and it has affecting how he makes his decisions. And he ends up defeated. It also turns out that the influence of another creature that was kind of had element. Tim would explain this better than I can, but there was the sentient creature that had elements of itself, drug that was using it to manipulate mutants around the world. Anyway, long story short, they have this big clash. It's the culmination, largely, of this one. Magneto kills Jean Grey. Wolverine kills Magneto, chops his head off, and that's it. Well, the editors at Marvel were not happy with this. They did not like they liked Zorn as a character. They tried to convince Morrison to change his story to keep Zorn around. They didn't want Magneto dead. And because even if you brought him back to life, he had massacred a bunch of people in New York, and it's hard to redeem someone from that.
Even so, he's supposed to be a villain.
The minute that Morrison leaves Marvel, Marvel launches a new volume of Excalibur, Chris Claremont and Aaron Lopresti, starring Professor Charles Xavier and Magneto living in the ruins of Genosha. Now, you might ask, Nick, doesn't Magneto not have a head anymore? Well, this is where it gets fun. Because Marvel reveals in that book that Zorn was not actually Magneto, but an imposter Magneto. And the real Magneto was not only alive, but completely innocent of all the things that happened in New York. Because then Zorn was some guy pretending to be Magneto, pretending to be Zorn. And then comes our boy, Chuck Austin. Chuck Austin, his run on X-Men, it's revealed that Zorn, his full name was Quan Yin Zorn. And he has a twin brother named Shin Zorn, who has a black hole where his head should be instead of a star. Now stay with me here. Quan Yin Zorn was apparently working with someone named John Sublime to impersonate Magneto and bring down the X-Men. Information that is learned by Emma Frost and her telepathy, which she just now used. Mm-hmm. Now.
Wait a minute. Wait. Okay. Emma Frost used her telepathy to see who he was. Why didn't Xavier do that before?
Because Xavier couldn't read because he had the helmet on. That's what it was. Yeah.
So why could Emma Frost read his mind?
Reasons.
All right.
But there's more. There's more. Not only does that not make sense, there's more. We don't know why Quan Yin Zorn wanted to impersonate Magneto and set him up and go through this elaborate ruse. Until the official handbook of the Marvel Universe in 2005, which revealed that it was the result of Scarlet Witch's meddling with reality prior to the House of M event, similar to Superboy Prime punching a hole in reality. Then comes New Avengers by Brian Michael Bendis and Scarlet Witch removed all the mutants' powers, or most of them. That energy that she removed formed a creature called the Collective. You've probably read this, Nick, which was essentially a incorporeal cloud made from those mutant powers. The Collective possesses an Alaskan man, Michael Pointer, kills Alpha Flight, and finds Magneto in Genosha. However, Magneto recognizes the dominant personality as being Quan Zorn.
Mm.
Zorn then explains that he took Magneto's image because he knew or hoped that Magneto was a symbol that mutant kind could rally around. However, following M-Day, Zorn had decided that now, more than ever, mutant kind needed the real Magneto back and offered to repower him. Magneto refused, and the Century threw the Collective into the sun. So, here's what we're left with, Nick. There are two Zorn brothers, Quan Yin's Ben Zorn.
Mm-hmm.
Quan Yin is a bad guy who pretended to be Magneto, pretending to be him, in an attempt to rally mutants behind his cause.
Right.
Quan Yin was killed by Wolverine, so found his way personality-wise into this Collective. And the Collective took a Grant Morrison story and made it more complicated than it was.
Yeah.
It was already complicated, but it was entertaining complicated. And because Marvel got cold feet to allow that in the first place, they decided to instantly retcon it in the worst, most Days of Our Lives manner possible. Twins. Terrible.
Twins.
Sorry. This was absolutely awful, Nick, and I don't like it. I don't care for it. And quite frankly, I think it deserved its spot on my list at number four. What are your thoughts on Zorn, Nick?
I don't know anything about a Zorn, but I'll trust you to hate it. I'll take your word for it.
When we do our very long book hunt on the entire Grant Morrison new X-Men, you'll run into Zorn.
Well, speaking of Grant Morrison, I got something here on my list. And I could pick so many moments awful Batman run. I could pick because really the entire thing is a change to the character of Batman. Numerous changes to the character of Batman over the entire run. But if I gotta pick one that just really grinds my gears, I'm gonna go with Batman Time Traveling Amnesiac. What I'm referring to here is the return of Bruce Wayne. And this is a story that followed Batman RIP, which you see Batman RIP was supposed to be the idea was they were going to kill Batman, but they didn't kill Batman in Batman RIP. He survived. But Batman then went directly from Batman RIP into Finalist and was Omega sanctioned because the Omega sanction is different than the Omega beam, apparently, Greg.
Right.
He was
right.
Omega sanctioned by Darkseid back in time. It disintegrated his body.
Yes. And wasn't he shot with a magic bullet or something?
No, he shot Darkseid with a magic bullet.
Oh, God almighty.
Yes, he broke his one rule and used a gun to shoot Darkseid with a magic bullet, but that's neither here nor there. So anyway, the Omega sanction zaps Bruce Wayne back in time, all the way back to the caveman days. But when it does so, it erases all his memories. He doesn't know why he's there or what's going on. He doesn't really understand, you know, what exactly is happening to him. And so what proceeds to play out over the course of six issues is Bruce Wayne stumbling around trying to piece together his memories. And every time he does something that is Batman-like, every time he starts to recover a bit of himself, he is flung forward in time. So he starts, like I said, in the prehistoric times. And then he jumps forward to the Salem witch trials, in which he uses his detective skills. Then he jumps forward to be a pirate at sea. And then
how do all this jumping through time again?
Every time he does something that where he recovers a bit of himself, he jumps forward through time.
Mm.
So, like in the prehistoric times, he's fighting this group of cavemen, and he beats them all, then winds up climbing down a waterfall or something. And when he arrives at the bottom of the waterfall, he realizes that he's been flung forward into Puritan times. So then he has to, use his detective skills there in the Puritan times and defeat a giant bat monster. And anyway, once he is able to save this woman, he jumps forward in time again. So anyway, he goes throughout time, gradually reclaiming bits of himself. And you know, when I think of Batman, Greg, I definitely think of time travel and amnesia storylines and weird psychobabble bullshit. I don't think of a grounded Dark Knight detective telling street-level stories. That's not what I think of at all. I think of this horseshit. This is what I want.
Weaver, Nick, he was doing that stuff in the 50s, and everything in his past is canon. All of it.
Yes, he was all of it. Everything in his past is canon. And then it eventually all winds up being, I believe the ultimate reveal was, and I don't know if this is accurate or not because it was so damn convoluted, it was revealed that he wasn't Bruce Wayne in different time periods, but instead he was possessing the body of his various ancestors through different time periods, and it was revealed that all his ancestors had been building to him becoming Batman. They had all been acquiring skills that were going to be passed down through some sort of genetic memory so that he could become the best version of Batman. They were all going to hide relics and secrets of their time period near where Wayne Manor was. It was just the stupidest fucking thing that ever happened. I hated it, Greg. I hated it.
Yes, but what did Le Bossu think about all this?
Le Bossu played no role.
Well, fuck. Listen, this story was horrible. Terrible. I remember it happening. Because at the same time they were doing the Return of Bruce, they were still doing Batman and Robin with Dick Grayson as Batman, which I was loving. I was loving all the Dick Grayson as Batman books at that time. And there's just this inevitable, you know, Bruce is coming back. They spoiled that by doing the literal return of Bruce Wayne. So you're almost just biding time at that point of when's Bruce going to come back and retake the role. But yeah, this return of Bruce Wayne, I've never read it actually. I intentionally didn't read it because it sounded so unlike a Batman story I would ever want to read. I'm not really interested in time traveling swashbuckler Batman. Like, it's maybe when I was 8, I probably would have liked that, but not now. And, you know, more power to the people that dug that, but ugh. I'm with you, man. I totally get it. It felt like a big, big, big departure from what we have seen, even in recent years at that point.
Yeah. It was on a long list of batshit insane Grant Morrison ideas that didn't land for me. This was just the most recent one. But thankfully, Morrison would move on to do Batman Incorporated, would cede control of both Batman and Detective Comics back over to more classic interpretations of Batman, and kind of was off doing his own thing with Batman Incorporated from there on out. And would leave Batman altogether, I think, what, like 20 issues into Batman Incorporated or something?
Something like that, yeah. Well, perhaps one day we'll revisit part of this Grant Morrison run. Well, shall we? Fair enough. Well, let's stick with DC Comics. And let's go a little bit beyond this story, not too far beyond this story, though, that we were just talking about, the return of Bruce Wayne. Let's go to 2011, and let's revisit the New 52, shall we, Nick?
If we must.
And indeed we must. Because let's talk about, okay, when I was whittling my list down tonight, it was very difficult. This was one of those difficult – sometimes our lists are easy to put together. This was one of the very difficult ones for me because there were so many options that I could put in here. But one of the commonalities of a lot of these options that I was looking at for this list was taking an existing iconic character and fundamentally changing the things that make them that character, changing their supporting casts, changing their – philosophies, changing their age to make them younger because of this weird comic book editor philosophy, publisher philosophy, Dan DiDio philosophy that young people react can relate more if the character is young, which I don't think has ever really been as true as people make it out to be. Maybe in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s when you had the kid character, I get that, but kids grew up reading Batman who were always portrayed as older men, as like adults in their late, at the youngest, their late 20s. Most of the time, they were portrayed as if they were in their mid 30s, adults with jobs and lives. We as kids could never relate to because we were kids. We didn't have to relate to them. We thought they were cool. We wanted to be them. They inspired us. And there's this notion that you have to de-age characters and make them younger and hipper and change their costumes and change the casts and bring them into the 21st century and make them swinging singles, baby. And they did that in 2011 with their oldest and most inspirational character, the Man of Steel himself, Superman. My number three selection is the New 52 version of Superman, where this hastily thrown together reboot of the entire DC universe character in Superman with such a rich history and such a rich cultural history, a heritage of who and what he is, what he stands for, what he believes in, what makes him a great and iconic character, his devotion to family, his love and his compassion for others, his ability to do the right thing in the face of any kind of trouble. Yes, he'll screw up. Yes, he's a human being, but at heart, even though he's an alien, but he's the best of us. He's trying to do the best that he can in all situations. And it's fine. And he's that guy that's wise, and he's the leader in a situation. He's not unsure of himself. He's not unsure of the world around him. He was like that when he was younger. He's gotten through that. He's got, oh, by the way, he's got a wife, Lois Lane, best female character in comics, in my opinion, who is a essential part of his life, of his comic. She's one of the great characters in all of fiction. And Jimmy Olsen and Perry White and all these people around him. Well, as of the New 52, throw all that out the window. The marriage is gone. Superman is now de-aged to his early 20s. They changed his costume, which whatever, that was the least important aspect to me. But they also made him more of a grit of street fighting character, like he may have been in the 30s when he first started. They made him rough around the edges, where he's got a little bit of an attitude about him. He doesn't trust people very well. His supporting cast has been neutered, essentially. He becomes a blogger instead of a newspaper reporter because newspapers are passe. And the whole thing is just so misguided. So misguided. They took Lois out of the picture. Lois is almost a non-factor in the New 52. Very much a non-factor. When she appears, she doesn't have any role. She is not given any agency to the story. She's put on the back burner in favor of Lana Lang at one point in an extensive run on Action Comics. We see this version of Superman that was unrecognizable to me, who's been reading Superman. The first comic book I ever read, Nick, as you know, was a Superman comic. Superman number 14 from 1988. First comic book I ever read in my life. And I did not recognize this character when I would try to pick up either issues of – it didn't matter if it was George Perez writing the book. It didn't matter if it was Dan Jurgens, if it was Scott Lobdell. No matter who was writing that New 52 Superman title, even I did not recognize the character. And I think in the end, we see by the success of DC Rebirth, which was largely put on the back of their bringing the old Superman back. That was one of the big hooks of Rebirth, was the proof to Superman coming back. That was a necessity because they had killed off that character. They had taken away so much from him in the want of making him trendy, in the want of making him youthful. And it was really an embodiment of wrong-sided thinking going back years in comics, where, oh, well, this character's sales are down. Let's make him younger. Nobody can relate to a married character. You know that, Nick. So we have to single again and have him date new characters because the old people, kids can't relate to relationships. Nobody knows what that's all about.
And put him in a relationship that further segments him from humanity rather than closer to it.
Yes. Put him in a relationship with Wonder Woman. And yes, and because that naturally they both have powers. They should be together, right?
Right.
They're the only two people powerful enough to be together. So explore that to the ends of the earth while again ignoring Lois. Ignoring the entire supporting cast, really. And crafting a character in New 52 Superman who – it was difficult to empathize with because he whined and he complained and it was not the Superman that we all loved. We want that wizened, and we needed him. We needed that wizened Superman because everybody in the New 52 was gritty. Everybody in the New 52 had an edge to them. There was no longer that character like Superman to be that kind of shining, that older, more assured figure. And it really hurt. It hurt the Superman fan base. It hurt the comics line, and it led to some of the worst Superman comics that you'll read. So glad that went the way of all things, died out, and now we've got the original OG Superman back. But again, the issue here is not even rebooting a character. The issue here is not even starting from scratch. Although I'd argue that was an unnecessary do. But the issue is building a new Superman who was lacking so much of what made Superman, if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense. Thankfully, I never really read in Superman, neither Action Comics nor the main title. I think I read Superman 50 that killed him off at the very end of the New 52 run, but that was pretty much it. So luckily, I was spared from most of that, except for his appearances in Justice League, and those were all written by Jeff Johns, so at least those were well written. You know, didn't really love the version of Superman that was there. But you mentioned, Greg, that comics readers clearly kept married characters, right? I mean, there's no way, no way that anyone would want to read a comic book about a married character.
No, that's boring. That's for old people.
It's boring. It absolutely is, which is why this shouldn't be on my list at all, but it is somehow, I guess, because I'm just wrong about this topic. And the number two entry on my list is a story from Marvel called Spider-Man One More Day.
Now, folks, this is the least surprising entry on either of our lists. You knew this was going to be on at least one of our lists.
Yes, I have railed, but give me some credit. I railed against it since it happened. And I was, God, when did this happen? This happened in 2007, I believe. And yes, the first issue launched in November of 2007, so technically the marriage was undone in January of 2008. I was 20 years old. I was one of those people who I was supposed to be the guy that they were trying to appeal to with this by making Peter young again and hip and all this stuff. And I didn't have any interest in it. And the reason why is because to me, what's great about comic characters, even though that doesn't really happen as often as it should, I see these characters grow. I like to see them move forward. I like to see them, you know, progress with their lives the way real people do. To me, that's much more relatable than being stuck in a constant, you know, state of being in your early 30s. That doesn't do anything for me. I understand the nature of the beast that it has to be that way, but we at least have the illusion of moving forward. And so when Marvel, who is a company who prides itself on having never rebooted our continuity, everything counts in the Marvel Universe, goes through such a lazy way of undoing something, it really just struck me the wrong way at the time. So a little context for this. Back when then Marvel Comics editor-in-chief Joe Quesada took over the job, one of his first things that he wanted to do was he felt like the marriage between Peter Parker and Mary Jane Watson that had happened, oh, when was that, Greg? Late
1987 or something.
Yeah, late 80s is what I was going to say. He felt like that needed to be undone because it was necessary to preserve the longevity of the Spider-Man character, because he felt like there were so many stories you could tell with a married Spider-Man, and that it had long since outlived its usefulness, and it was time to move the character back to a more classic status quo. Luckily, he was not able to do this right away when he came onto the job. He kept searching for a storytelling mechanism, a way to do it, and eventually, when Civil War happened in 2000,
it's almost like Nick. If a couple breaks up, you might think they would just get a divorce.
We'll get to that. I got some quotes from Joey Q. I'm going to read here in a little bit. So he was looking for a way to get out of this marriage for a long time, and in 2007, events kind of started to materialize that were going to lead him to be able to do this. One was that longtime writer J. Michael Straczynski had finally announced to depart the title. He had been the writer for, God, I mean, a decade, a literal decade, I believe, at this point. He had been one of the tenured Spider-Man writers, and so Quesada wanted to see him off with a major storytelling development that would provide something of a fresh start for the new creative team. What also happened around this time was the event Civil War that saw Peter Parker publicly unmask. So now you've got two problems in mind of Joey Quesada, even though, by the way, he you know, gave the okay to the public unmasking. The problems are you've got a Spider-Man without a secret identity, so everybody is, and you've got this married Spider-Man, to both of which he thinks are terrible things, even though I would argue there's a lot of story to be mined
there. I think both of them are good things.
Of a Spider-Man who's married, has a family, and everyone knows who he is. There's a lot of material to be mined there. And all that material was, of course, mined in four issues. That, of course, being the four-issue story, Back in Black. What happens in Back in Black is after the events of Civil War, Peter is disillusioned. He famously swapped sides during that conflict, moving from Iron Man's pro-registration side to Captain America's anti-registration side. And as a result, he has put himself in – he no longer has to deal with the federal government. His family are fugitives. He has ruined – essentially ruined his family's lives all because of this moral stand he makes. And because he no longer has the support of the federal government, the Kingpin is able to launch an attack against his family, and Aunt May is mortally wounded in the process. So what follows back in Black is the storyline One More Day, and what happens here is Peter is frantically searching for ways to save Aunt May,
to save his 173-year-old Aunt May.
Yes, who, by the way, if you've listened to the Marvel Age podcast, pretty much was perpetually on her deathbed from the character's creation up through 1969. So we've read about 7 years of Aunt May having fainting spells and being bedridden. So this lady has been on death's doorway.
She's going to go, Peter. Just let her go.
Yeah, just let her go.
She probably wants to die at this point.
But see, Peter, you know, his thought process is he put her in that position. And so he doesn't want the guilt of having to deal with both Ben and Aunt May's deaths being on him. So anyway, he's going to find a way to save Aunt May. And he goes around and he goes to Doctor Strange first. He's like, hey, man, you're the most powerful, you know, mystic on the face of the planet. You can use your mystic powers to save Aunt May. And Doctor Strange says, nope, can't do it. I don't have the power to bring people back. He is already about to cross over the ethereal plane or some such bullshit.
Peter, she's been dead since 1982.
Yes, it's just a literal corpse you've been carrying around and talking to. It's actually quite disturbing. So that doesn't work. So he sets off to find help from others. He's Reed Richards. Tries Reed Richards. Reed Richards is no help. Surprise, surprise there.
Sorry, Peter. I'm looking at my Bunsen burner.
You can't do anything for
you.
I
can't hear you.
Dr. Doom, because, you know, Dr. Doom has tried notoriously to bring his mother back from the dead. Dr. Doom can't help him and wouldn't help him anyway. Our favorite, the High Evolutionary. He goes and asks him for some help.
Why didn't he help?
No help from the High Evolutionary.
Why?
And finally, you know, the one he didn't call, Dr. Octopus. He figures, if anything, Doc Ock would take pity on his former lover, May Parker, and help bring her back to life. But can't do that either.
Elton John and B. Arthur getting it on.
So nothing is happening. So Peter breaks in to the Sanctum Sanctorum and says, you know what? If Doctor Strange won't help me, I'm going to figure out a way to do it myself. And he steals these magical relics and he uses a spell to try and send himself back in time to stop Aunt May from ever being injured in the first place. In the process, he wounds himself because he's an idiot who doesn't know what he's doing. So Doctor Strange shows up and like, listen, Peter, we gotta have a come to Jesus meeting here. It's not gonna happen. You gotta go be with your aunt in her final moments. It's all I can do. So Peter finally accepts it, realizes that there's nothing he can do for her. And Strange heals his wounds and sends him on his way. And as Peter is walking to the hospital, he encounters this mysterious little girl who tells Peter that, hey, I saw your problems for you, and she runs off. And Peter gives chase, and when he finally tracks her down, she transforms into the demon Mephisto, who's got a proposition for Peter. He is going to save Aunt May in exchange for Peter giving up his marriage to Mary Jane.
Now, what does Mephisto gain out of this?
Mephisto gains that marriage, their marriage, I'm happy, and Mephisto hates when people are happy. You know, he's the literal devil. He wants to remove all the happiness and joy from the world. So
he doesn't even get their everlasting souls, Everett.
Nope. He gets the marriage taken away.
Good Lord.
So they Peter and Mary, he gives Peter and Mary Jane 24 hours to talk it over. So they go talk it over and they decide, you know what? It's worth it. We're gonna do it. On one caveat. We want something else, Mephisto. You've got to help us have Peter's secret identity restored to the world. So in one fell swoop, we have done away with the secret identity reveal, which just happened like 6 months earlier. And we're also going to undo this marriage. And so finally, in the final scenes, we see Peter and this forces Peter and Mary Jane to watch their greatest moments as a married couple, and also what the future would have held from them, all dissolve away in front of them as they shed tears. The next thing Peter knows, he wakes up, he doesn't recognize his surroundings, and it turns out he is back living with Aunt May again, because that's what we needed. And not only that, but when he goes downstairs, it's his birthday, and Harry Osborn is now been resurrected as a result of whatever prior events were changed. And all of the guests toast to a brand new day. This would wind up ushering in a terrible era of Spider-Man comics. At first, starting with thrice monthly publication of Amazing Spider-Man that saw rotating writers and artists tell different stories depending on which week of the month you were picking the story up with. Most notably, it saw the introduction of one Daniel Slott into the Spider-Man writing team, who would eventually take over the title full-time when it went back to once a month. And, of course, I have made my disdain for the Dan Slott Spider-Man run well-known throughout this time.
Now, Ben Morse is not going to be happy to hear that, I don't think.
Well, Ben Morse doesn't like a lot of my takes. You know, I also think 90s Connor Kent is trash, so there you go. In any event, the problem was they never really revealed what had changed and what hadn't. Like, Joe Quesada kept saying in interviews, well, the idea is that all of the stories you know still happened, except they just weren't married. They were just a couple, and then they broke up at some point. And so people would say, oh, what about Mary Jane being pregnant? Like, well, that one didn't. And they're like, but you just said all the other things happened. And he'd be like, well, you know. So eventually they tried to kind of massage this a little bit with a follow-up story called One Moment in Time. Because actually wrote this himself to kind of clarify some continuity changes. And what wound up happening, the reveal was this. Mephisto's only change to the timeline was that on the day of Peter and Mary Jane's wedding, he set a criminal free from prison, who Spider-Man had to stop on the way to his wedding, was late for his wedding, Mary Jane got mad because he was late, and realized that being Spider-Man would always be a higher priority than his marriage, and wound up calling the whole thing off. Fucking stupid. Because they had gone over that many times in the lead-up to the wedding, if you recall, or if anyone recalls. It just made no sense. But not only that, they revealed that the person who actually saved Aunt May from her injuries was Doctor Strange, despite saying in One More Day that he literally could not save her from her injury. Not only that, they revealed that the way that people didn't remember his secret identity was Reed Richards, Doctor Strange, and Tony Stark got together and secretly engineered a specialized the extremist virus from Iron Man and spread it across the entire globe. And the only thing this virus did was keep people from knowing that Peter Parker was Spider-Man.
Oh my lord.
Now, you know, I have railed against this for many years, and you asked, Greg, you asked right up front, why wouldn't they just do a divorce? That, you know, why wouldn't they just have a divorce? It makes the most sense, right? You could do that. I mean, do right. It. You know, just do that. Well, Joe Quesada, I had a little bit of, let's see here. I'm trying to find the exact quote. I had it. Oh, where'd it go? Give me one moment.
Yeah, the Phillies won.
Come on, where is it? Damn it.
Well, you're searching for that. I'll kill time.
Okay, buddy. Here we go. Quesada feels that, here we go, that this the deal with Mephisto is a better resolution than Peter and Morse, because it would, quote, indicate they gave up on their love, that their life and love together was so awful, so stressful, so unfulfilling, that they had to wave a red flag and walk away from it. They quit on their marriage, and even more tragically, they quit on each other. Instead, we had them make a deal with the devil, because that isn't as bad. Peter and MJ didn't quit on their love. They sacrificed it to save a life. And that, to me, is a pretty heroic story.
Yes, nothing more heroic than making Satan.
Deal with the literal incarnation of Satan. Now, in the years since,
a selfish deal, Because the reason that they're making that deal is so Peter won't feel guilt about something he did.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Giving up all these things that had helped to differentiate Spider-Man from other Marvel heroes in 1987. The marriage was a defining characteristic of the character. And again, if you don't want to do it, I would argue that there's a much more relatable and, you know, human way to tell that, telling the story of someone going through a divorce. It doesn't have to be an ugly divorce, but it can be something where you're like, hey man, this just isn't working out for whatever reason. That's something that happens to real people every day. If the Marvel Universe is supposed to be a reflection of the universe outside our window, what's more realistic than that, than showing a divorce in a world where marriages end in divorce? It's extremely frustrating. But what has been even more frustrating is over the last 5 years, Marvel has continued to poke and prod and taunt people by continuing to tease that they might undo it at some point. And you might ask yourself, well, they probably could do that. You know, why don't they do that since they now have a younger, hipper Spider-Man and Miles Morales running around anyway? Wouldn't it serve to differentiate Miles from Peter? The answer is yes, it would, but they won't because they suck. The end.
That was good, Nick. That was dramatic. That was well delivered. Almost sounded rehearsed, but I know it wasn't. Very well done. And I support your putting it on your list. I think it was a worthy entry. Because again, Nick, it comes down to the principle of taking everything that made Spider-Man unique, or many of the things that made Peter Parker in particular unique, and stripping them away.
Mm-hmm. I think I know where you're going with this.
Well, I'm going to have to hold that because I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Mm. Because before we get there, there's another example of it than the one that I think you were thinking of. But I think this one's going to set you up nicely for your number one, if I'm correct, what number one might be. My number two is another long-standing character who came to prominence largely in the 1960s, and a character who has become near and particularly in the last couple decades, a character who at one time resembled Dan Quayle, a character by the name of Hal Jordan, the Green Lantern.
That's my
Mm-hmm. I'm going to set you up perfect, Nick, because I'm going to focus on one aspect of it, and then I'm going to just volley it over to you to handle the rest of it. So my number two is the transformation of Hal Jordan into the villain Parallax. Mm. Let me preface by saying that I do believe that it is possible to have heel turns in comics. Mm-hmm. I think it is possible to tell the story of a natural heel turn in some isolated cases.
I think we should preface this entire segment of the show with we still hate this despite the fact that it laid the foundation for one of the greatest things to ever happen in comics, John's Green Lantern run. We are analyzing this as it happened, not as it wound up being used and retconned and improved 20 years later.
Right. I also say this knowing that there were comics that came out of this. There were some good Green Lantern comics that came out of this, and some bad ones, and some forgettable ones. But what I'm talking about is this transition of Hal Jordan to Parallax. There is a way to tell a heel turn story in comics. It has to be dealt with, it has to be sparingly done, but it can be done. We've seen it. But let's explain why this is one of the worst and tackiest ways a superhero heel turn. So let's go back to the early 1990s. Green Lantern in the post-Crisis on Infinite Earths era has been kind of reimagined a few times. And in particular, Hal Jordan has been kind of reshaped and refocused into an elder statesman of the superhero community. He's got graying temples. He's portrayed as one of the founding members of the Justice League. And he's kind of trying to find his way in the world. He's almost at not quite a mid-crisis of sorts, where he's trying to find his way and deal with the things that he's done in his past, whether it be his road travels with Oliver Queen, whether it be his multiple failed attempts at a relationship with Carol Ferris and various others. And he's trying to hold together the Green Lantern Corps as they're going through lots of different transitions involving the Guardians and the New Guardians and all kinds of things going on in the late 80s and early 90s. Well, at a certain point, the sales on the Green Lantern comic were just stagnating. They weren't what DC Comics were hoping for. And at the same time, DC was seeing historic sales in Batman and Superman thanks to some radical changes going on, some radical storylines, namely, first and foremost, the death of Superman, which was the most successful storyline in all of comics at that time. And it was doing gangbuster sales, getting mainstream attention. They were killing off Superman. Fast forward a little bit, and you have Nightfall going on in Batman, where you're breaking Batman's back. And both of these storylines involve temporary, that we didn't know were temporary at the time, replacements. Reign of the Superman, you've got a leather jacket clad Superboy that Nick has talked about earlier. You've got John Henry Irons, a steel worker who literally wears an iron or a steel Superman suit. You've got the Eradicator, a Superman who kills people. You've got Cyborg Superman who looks like a Terminator. And meanwhile, over in Batman, Bruce Wayne gets his back broken and is replaced by a grittier, armored murdering Batman in Jean-Paul Valley, Azrael. So the bigwigs at DC, they think, you know what? We need to fix Green Lantern. The sales are not where we want it. We need a big event like Nightfall. We need a big event like Death of Superman. We need an event called Twilight. And at this time, Emerald Twilight is planned out by the writer, Gerard Jones, who we're not here to discuss his personal foibles, which are many. But the idea was to do a big, you know, status quo changing Green Lantern event. Well, let's go back to Reign of the Superman. Of course, if people remember this storyline, most of the people listening to this podcast have probably read that story, but the Cyborg Superman is revealed to be a bad guy, and he and Mongol detonate a bomb over Coast City, which of course was Hal Jordan's hometown, where his family, his friends, his loved ones were. They detonate a bomb in the town. They destroy the city of Coast City. And Green Lantern is actually on the ship when this happens. And Green Lantern and Superman, the returned Superman, launch an attack on Cyborg and Mongol to take them out. Long story short, they succeed in taking out Mongol and the Cyborg Superman, but Coast City has been vanquished and destroyed, and Hal Jordan is devastated. You would think if your entire town were destroyed, you know, well, maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, so we're having a bit of a connection issue here in our studio where we both are in person. So I'm going to ride it out for a moment by killing time and talking about Green Lantern. So Green Lantern is there, and he takes out Mongol. He has his arm broken at some point and puts it in a green suit. And when it's done, what do? Your city's destroyed. You know, your loved ones are either dead or out of town. Carol Ferris was out of town with her husband, who she's, you know, not Hal, obviously. And Hal's left to kind of pick up the pieces. Well, here's the problem. If at this point Hal Jordan suffers a psychological break and it drives him crazy that he can't get the power to restore Coast City, it might make some level of sense. He might be able to pull that story off. But that's not what happens. Because right after this happens, Hal goes and he meets up with his old pal Oliver Queen to try to get comfort, going to his best friend in a time of need. And Ollie does his best to comfort Hal. He's on a mission to save Carol Ferris from this, I don't remember the details of the story, but there's some kind of plot involving some guy who's going to kill Carol and her husband. Hal and Ollie go on a trip together again. They rescue Carol. They bond. And the whole point of this mini story arc, it's about a 2 or 3 issue story. The whole point of it is Hal going through the stages of grief and learning to deal with what has happened to Coast City. It is a huge status quo changing event for him. And he deals with it. Like, he doesn't get over it, but he starts turning the corner on it. Well, then DC gets Gerard Jones' pitch for Emerald Twilight. They say it's not drastic enough. They trash it. Gerard Jones is removed from Green Lantern, replaced on Earth, and DC creates a new Emerald Twilight, an editorially mandated Emerald Twilight, where the news story is that Hal Jordan goes from being able to deal with it to not being able to deal with it. And now Hal wants to recreate Coast City using his Green Lantern ring.
As a matter of fact, Greg, Emerald Twilight opens with Hal in the middle of the ruins of the destroyed Coast City,
yes,
wearing a sling on his arm, as if the story you just referenced had at all.
Had not happened.
Even though it had just happened.
Yep. So Hal tries to recreate Coast City with his power ring, even going so far as to bring his mother and father back from the dead briefly to converse with them. Even though they're just constructs of his ring, they're not real people, so they're just constructs of his subconscious. Ganthet of the Guardians comes down and tells Hal, "I'm sorry for your loss, but there's nothing we can do." Even though they probably could if they wanted to, what to do?
Can't use the ring for personal gain.
Yes, you can't use the ring for personal gain. That's Hal says. Well, that's bullshit.
Bullshit.
He basically says to the Guardians that you got power for personal gain numerous times, going off to fornicate with the Zamorons and all that stuff. And Ganthet says, "Ah," and Hal says, "You know what? If you're not going to give me that power, take." And Hal flies off towards Oa. Well, the Guardians know what's coming, and so they organize a strike force to intercept Hal. It's all of his friends. It's Hal's best friends, the Green Lantern Corps. Mm-hmm. People like Jack T. Chance, mm-hmm, and people like Iolanda, not Iolanda, she was a later character, but what's her name? The princess. They did a story on the Emerald Knights movie on her.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
You know the one, yeah.
Lyra.
And she's there. Aresia, I think, shows up at one point.
Kilowog
shows up. The Guardians even go so far as to free Sinestro from his prison inside the Green Lantern battery, mm-hmm, tasking him with taking out Hal Jordan, stopping him from getting to Oa. And Hal not only fights all of these people along the way, he kills them. He kills his best friends as he's flying through space and fighting them, and or renders them useless or inert or leaves them for dead in the vacuum of space. Finishes it all off by breaking Sinestro's neck. And then he goes to Oa and he kills the Guardians and he absorbs all the power in the Green Lantern battery, the master battery, and he emerges as Parallax. And then, in the Zero Hour event, he decides to destroy the universe and recreate it in his image. Mm-hmm. So, in a span of a few issues, Hal Jordan has gone from hero who takes out Mongol as Superman and saves his ex alongside his best friend to the most evil man in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
This is not how you do a heel turn, Nick.
Nope, no it is not.
This is the equivalent of Dean Ambrose turning heel and the next week coming out promos about how stinky the fans are and it being a toxic waste zone. It's horrible. It's stupid. From the get-go, I hate it. Even as a kid, Nick, I had no strong attachment to Green Lantern when I was a kid. I wasn't a regular reader. I had some issues here that I would read that I thought looked interesting, but I wasn't a diehard Green Lantern fan or anything. But I hated this when I was a kid. I didn't think it was cool what they were doing to Hal. I didn't buy it. I thought it was a cool story to tell of him being a hero turning into a villain, but I didn't like the way they did it. I thought his costume was cool as Parallax, and I'll give him that. But this was just so obviously editorially mandated. It was so not in keeping with their own stories that it intended. And again, as you mentioned, Nick, trying to ignore that the previous issues had even happened. But then also the transition for Hal of going from 0 to 100 on the ego so fast. There was no organic build to it. He goes from I'm sad that all these people got killed to
I am so sad and angry about it that I am willing to kill people that I have gone to war with, my brothers and my sisters. I'm willing to kill them just so I can get there and enact my evil supervillain plot.
Yeah, I agree with all of this. This is my number one entry is this, and I kind of combine this entire like year of Green Lantern stories into one thing because they massively overhauled the entire like concept of what it meant to be a Green Lantern in the DC universe. So you have covered that excellently. I'll pick up and say it's not just enough that they took Hal Jordan and ruined that character. They then followed it up by, well, you know, the Guardians are gone except for Ganthet. Ganthet survives. Ganthet is able to live on. And instead of relaunching the Green Lantern Corps, instead of, again, taking and using the Green Lantern Corps, the core, the idea of the central power battery and the thousands of Green Lanterns and the idea that every lantern uses the ring differently and the idea that the ring has to choose someone to be worthy of induction into this core.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of keeping that central tenet and that defining character of Green Lantern as a concept, DC scraps it all and they said, nope, we're just going to have one Green Lantern, just one Green Lantern. And does the ring choose him? No. Gets up on Earth and gives it to some guy. And that guy, Kyle Rayner. And here I am.
A young, struggling artist,
Kyle Rayner.
Who's a single guy that swings around, not unlike Spider-Man in terms of his, he's a young, artistic guy that lives on his own in an apartment, has a hot girlfriend. You know, it was just, let's make this character younger and hipper and fresher. Let's make him 90s. And, you go ahead, Nick. I don't want to interrupt you, but man, you're really touching it off for me here.
But here's the problem. Despite his hot girlfriend, despite his artistic ability, Kyle Rayner was a boring-ass character. And was, I don't want to say it, Kyle Rayner was boring until Geoff Johns made him better. The Ron Mars stuff is nothing to write home about. I don't give two shits about it. 90s Kyle Rayner can suck it for all I care. But in addition to replacing Hal Jordan with an inherently boring character, they also ruined what made Green Lantern cool in the first place.
Yes.
Lantern is supposed to be an expansive mythology, bigger than just one character, almost like its own entire universe added on to the DC universe. Worlds upon worlds, thousands and thousands of characters.
And if you didn't like Hal Jordan, that's cool because you could like Jon Stewart or you could like Kilowog or Aurelia
or any of the alien. Yes, any of the alien Lanterns, except none of those are Green Lanterns anymore.
Nope.
Not a Green Lantern, though they would undo that pretty quickly. Guy Gardner, not a Green Lantern anymore. Kilowog, gone. Aresha, gone. Chip, gone. Tomar Ray, gone. Salon, all of them gone. No Green Lanterns, no core, no nothing, no larger unit that Kyle Rayner has to figure out how to operate within. Instead, he's just another Earth-based hero operating alongside the Justice League with a secret identity.
A secret identity.
And nothing else to differentiate him from anybody else. Thus, we embarked on 10 years of bad Green Lantern stories. There, I said it. I'll stand by it. I've read every Green Lantern issue in the history of the character. That is the worst in Green Lantern history because it isn't Green Lantern. They took Green Lantern and tried to make it into something it wasn't, and it sucked as a result. So the combination of ruining Hal Jordan, destroying the core, and installing Kyle Rayner as the one and only Green Lantern is by far the least character change in all of comics history, even though it ultimately was used as the groundwork for the greatest Green Lantern run of all time when Geoff Johns took over the character.
Absolutely, but we're not going to give them credit for that because that wasn't the original plan. The plan was to move forward with Kyle Rayner as the only Green Lantern, which they did for many, many years. And the word that I've often used to describe that, Nick, is reductive.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a reductive approach to the Green Lantern myth. They took something grand and they shrunk it down and they made it like anything else. He has a magic, what does Grant Morrison refer to as a wishing ring, a magic wishing ring. And that's the only thing that makes him different is his weapon. But that was never what Green Lantern cool to me or cool. It wasn't the weapon. It wasn't the Green Ring. It was the mythos. It was that you're on this team. You're part of a unit. You're part of a universe-wide collection of people that have this magic ring in different ways. And maybe you don't all get along, but you're going to have to interact with all these strange and interesting weird creatures. And now you're turning Green Lantern into Nova or any other character that occasionally ventures off into space. You know, that I'm never in favor, or rarely am I in favor, of changes to a character that make them more like other characters.
Right.
And that's what they did with this. I agree with you. I resented her for many, many years as a comic book fan, even though I missed a big chunk of that Ron Mars run. I resented the character until Geoff Johns, Dave Gibbons, and Peter Tomasi kind of reimagined him in the pages of Green Lantern Corps after Rebirth happened. And Green Lantern Rebirth, that is. And that's when I started enjoying Kyle Rayner, but not until then. And I know there's a lot of people that are going to find that controversial, but I don't care. That's just my own. I lived through it. That's how I always felt that way. I always, even when I was 10 years old and I was the target audience for Kyle Rayner, I thought Kyle Rayner was lame. I thought he was repetitive. I thought he was too many characters. And I resented the fact that they were crapping on an entire mythology, an entire universe of characters in favor of pushing the new shiny thing. You know, it's the equivalent of Poochie on The Simpsons, the Itchy and Scratchy and Poochie show, where, hey, here's this brand new kid. We're going to tell you how cool he is and have everybody else talk about how cool he is and have kind of an edge about him. And there's nothing less cool than that. So awesome selection for number one. Ultimately, I hated that, Nick. There's one character that I think was done even less justice.
Yes, go ahead.
Because at number one, I am taking, you could argue, is an innocuous aspect of a character, but I would argue that this particular story and this particular decision, more than that, fundamentally altered the course of my favorite Marvel character and ruined him, as he'll never recovered from it in the comics. My number one selection is the decision to reveal the origin of Wolverine. And it was done, of course, in the book Wolverine Origin, which we've talked about on the show before. Paul Jenkins, I believe, wrote it. And I think maybe Joe Quesada drew it. It was Quesada's idea. He was one of the linchpins of it. So, as all horrible character comics do, this started with a reactionary decision from an executive. And in this case, the success of the film was such that Joe Quesada, Bill Gemas, I think, was part of this process as well, and maybe Paul Jenkins, I can't remember, and Marvel bigwigs, Marvel decision makers, they started to get antsy because, to this point, one of the big aspects of Wolverine, including in that first X-Men movie that made it into there, that was on the cartoon, that was in the comics, one of the defining characteristics of Wolverine was that he did not know who he was, really. We had had hints, we had had theories, we had had red herrings, plenty of them over the years, but they had never revealed what his origin was. He was a drift, an eternal Ronin, without a masterless samurai, cursed to roam forever looking for clues to who he really was. An argument could be made that maybe they had beaten that in around time to end it. I would say that that's not true. I think you can end the story of him trying to look for clues, but I think part of what fundamentally made him interesting was the fact that there was mystery there. As a kid, I remember at school with my friends, we have our own theories on what his origins were. We would try to take clues from the comics, the little breadcrumbs that would be dropped, and we came up with our own ideas of Sabretooth's his dad, or Sabretooth's his brother, or Mr. genetically engineered him, or all these different theories that we had as kids, and every one of them was better than what Marvel came up with. So Marvel decides, in their infinite wisdom, hey, if we don't reveal Wolverine's origin,
The movies are going to do it. And that will become his cultural origin. You know, Nick, like how the fact that Tim Burton's Batman showed Joker's origin made that his definitive origin in the comics.
Yeah, right? And we all now refer to Jack being the one true Joker, right?
The one true Joker, yes, absolutely. We all know that the Joker killed Batman's parents because they did it in the movie. So that was the thought process, is gosh, we can't let Bryan Singer and Fox come up with Wolverine's origin. That would we got a bitch. And so they start brainstorming Wolverine origin. And they decide to take a character who is so rooted in fan theory and speculation and mystery. There's that word again, mystery. And they decided that he was a sick aristocrat boy in 1780s or 1870s Canada, who's the son of a wealthy family, and his mutation kind of kicks in after a traumatic event in his childhood. And they show us this aristocrat boy growing up and dealing with his bone claws and his evolving healing factor that makes him no longer sickly. And we learn that he, over time, it that very healing factor leads to his some of his memory issues and things like that. So it heals his memories from him. And regardless of whether anybody thinks Wolverine Origin is a good story or not, I'm not going to debate that. I didn't like it, but some do. That's not the point. The point was the very idea to reveal Wolverine's origin fundamentally altered that character, because now we know as an audience what origin is, and eventually they told the story of Wolverine finding out what his origin was and who he really was. Then all the mystery's gone. Not only does the audience no longer have to find out, have nothing left to find, Wolverine himself has nothing left to find out. So that began a decade-plus long tenure of them, as Tim and I have talked about, completely forgetting the point of Wolverine. Wolverine, in that decade, became the leader of the X-Men. He became Cyclops, essentially. Remember that CM Punk and John Cena promo where CM Punk tells John Cena that you've become the thing you hate the most, you've become the Yankees?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much this. Wolverine becomes Cyclops. He becomes the do-gooder leader of the X-Men that runs the school and teaches the classes and speaks properly and all that stuff. They completely lost the plot with him. They lost that Ronin aspect that defined Logan for so many years, that made him my favorite Marvel character, that made him a generation of kids' favorite Marvel character, all because they didn't want to let the movies come up with the origin for him, which they might not have anyway. And dare I say it, Nick, if they had, it probably would have been a hell of a lot more interesting than James Howlett, young boy in 1800s Canada.
Because the movies eventually wound up using the stupid aristocrat thing, like X-Men Origins Wolverine. So it's a bad comic story that led to arguably a worse movie.
Absolutely, 100%. And if they had just left it to its own, they might have come up with a better origin in the movies. We don't know. And if they came up with a shitty one, you can just ignore it like you do with the movies. So so off base, and this one sticks in my craw the most of any character change, because I've said this on podcasts with other people recently, that I know that I can even say who my favorite Marvel character is right now, because Wolverine's always been my answer to that, but I don't recognize him. I don't recognize the guy that got trapped in an adamantium case and killed now. You know, I don't get it. I recognize Old Man Logan. That's kind of the Wolverine that I grew up reading. But they took a character who was so simple and so iconic and so easily attached, and they've, again, Nick, taken away everything that made him unique.
Yeah. I mean, you pretty much nailed it. I have never actually read Wolverine Origin, somehow. I don't know how. And I don't have any intention of ever doing it. It's like if they were to do a definitive Joker origin in comics. Like, it defeats the entire point. It takes what makes that character special and throws it out the window. And I have no interest in ever reading it.
Yeah, it's the equivalent. You know, we've talked about this with that Joker. Anytime they talk about revealing the Joker's origin, we mention this, that it's the same deal. The Joker is that same kind of character that if you know his origin, it takes away something from him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the case with Wolverine as well. And he's a character that, you know, not maybe they can redeem him somehow at some point, but if ever there was a character that I would like to one more day, it would be one more day where he makes a deal with Mephisto where his origin never happened. You know, like he became so he comes out of, or that was revealed to be a mirage or an illusion or whatever. But I just hate it so much. But anyway, what did we get right or wrong? I know we're going to hear some blowback on some of this stuff. So hit us up on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. And if you do disagree with any of our choices, you can also tweet us at our burner account at JRsBBQ. You can go to the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page and leave us your list of the 5 worst character changes in comics. Do you agree with some of ours? What are some of the ones we might have forgotten about or left off? Are there any out there that you guys want to bring some attention to as being particularly painful or angering to you? And real quick, Nick, I'm gonna read off a couple of my honorable mentions that just missed my list without getting into too much of the details here. I had Wade Hal Jordan, if you remember that, from the end of the New 52 era.
Mm-hmm.
I have Teenage Iron Man from the 90s. This was when a time-displaced Tony Stark was brought in to be the hip, young, new Iron Man, replacing the evil, old Tony Stark that we all knew. And that was back in the 90s. I have DC wasting the Red Hood by changing him from a villain to a rather generic hero back in the mid-2000s. And I have, finally, Guy Gardner Warrior. Enough said on that.
Mm. Well done, sir. Well done.
Any for you?
None.
Very good. Well, folks, let us hear those lists. Shoot them our way on Facebook. Shoot them our way on Twitter. Or you can tweet at PTB and Comics. And in the meantime, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we've got Reading, Watching, and we've got the Rundown.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on 2 great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB In Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Still don't know what I was waiting for, and my time was running wild in the dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse how the others must see a baker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Welcome back, ladies and germs. To the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We hope you enjoyed our countdown, and again, we do want to see those lists. But now, it's time to move on to a segment where we talk about what we've been reading and watching.
Wait! There's none, so we're not even going to do the segment.
I got nothing. Nope, I got nothing. No reading, no watching.
We're lazy as fuck.
That's right. Wait, you have been watching something, though, Nick.
No, I haven't. Not this week. Not since last time, pretty much.
Oh, well, never mind then. So let's move on to our weekly look at the news and notes for comics. Mm-hmm. It's a segment known far and wide across the known hemispheres as The Rundown. And let this month's rundown by talking about a rather unusual and not well-explained decision by DC Comics. And by explained, I mean the details I can't seem to find the story for. But DC Comics has announced this week that it has partnered with Comixology Unlimited, Kindle Unlimited, and Amazon Prime. Various DC Comics added to Amazon's Comixology Unlimited subscription service. Thousands of single issues and collections have been added to the service. This is in addition to DC Universe, which of course is DC's in-house subscription service that includes movies, TV shows, and comics. Now, Comixology Unlimited is $5.99 a month, flat rate subscription. It also contains some titles from Marvel Comics, IDW, Dark Horse, Boom, Valiant, Dynamite, and others. Only available to U.S. residents. DC has also added several collections and original graphic novels to Amazon's other flat-rate reading services, Kindle Unlimited and Prime Reading, which comes with you, free with your Amazon Prime account, apparently. Although searching titles on that, on mobile anyway, is a little difficult, I've found, to find which ones are Prime and which ones are not. But nonetheless, pretty surprising to me to see this announcement, given that DC has its own service. And this indicates to me that things may not be going very well.
Now, to be fair, let's say up front, Marvel also houses content on Comixology Unlimited and these other platforms, while yes. also maintaining Marvel Unlimited. So
that's fair. Yep.
They're able to have both. Here's my issue with this. If you're going to take comics content that is not on DC Universe and put it somewhere else, why is it not on DC Universe?
Yep.
Why did I pay you $75 up front for this service that you promised was going to be, again, your tagline, not mine, the ultimate DC membership, and yet I have to go other places to get things? There's no reason why I should have to go to Hoopla through my library, College Unlimited, to read, for example, the entire first volume of the Peter David Aquaman. No reason. Why should I have to do that, Greg?
Not only that, but you have to pay to go to Comixology Unlimited or Kindle Unlimited to read this extra content.
Makes no sense. So if you're going to do this, have it be a small snapshot of what would be available on DC Unlimited or DC Universe.
Agreed.
But as of right now, it sounds like this is probably going to wind up being more comprehensive than DC Universe comics content.
Because it won't be rotational.
So let me tell you what's going to happen with me. When did DC Universe launch? September?
September, yeah.
Yep. So my annual subscription comes up in September. I'll be canceling that subscription and just getting a Comixology Unlimited subscription because I'm far more interested in the comics library than I am their original content, because any original content they produce, I can find a way to watch. I'm not worried about that. I want the comics reader, and they have made zero effort to heavily invest in the comics from my standpoint. Despite the high-quality video content that's on DC Universe, there's not enough of it. There's not enough comics content. For me, at this point, DC Universe is a bust.
I am not willing to go as far as say that it's a bust, because I do like the service. I like the functionality of the service.
But do you like it relative to the amount? Do you feel like it is a good value for your money?
No, it is not worth the money that I paid.
Right.
For
this. That is my point.
I don't use it enough for that.
Right.
And the reason I don't use it enough is because I had to use Hoopla to read a missing issue from our Peter David volume that we were doing, issue zero. And, you know, we would probably use DC Universe if not every month, then every other month to read long book stuff for trades, graphic novels. But we can't rely on it because we don't know which ones are going to be on there from month to month and gone. Now, some of them that are there we can use and have used, but it's just so unpredictable as to what's going to be there and what's going to be gone. The original content is being rolled out slowly. They don't do the Marvel or the Netflix approach of dropping everything where you can pace. Which I understand that's a choice that they made, but it's still something to consider. The overall amount of content at one time just isn't – there's a lot of – no question. And I could go through right now and enjoy the service. But is it worth $75?
No. Especially considering it's small snippets of various series. You're not going to have – there are very few extensive runs on there, very few.
Mm-hmm. And then when you add in the video content is rotation. One week the Dark Knight's on there, the next week it's not. One week Batman Forever's on there, the next week it's not. The only stuff that seems to be is the TV content. And who knows when they're gonna decide to randomly take some of that down.
Right.
I agree, man. I hate to say this because I love the functionality of it. You know, you and I have watched videos on there and I've read comics on there, and I love their reader. I really do. I think it's more intuitive than a lot of the e-readers that I've used. But none of that matters if the content is not enough to justify the money. We're moving into an environment now, Nick, where we're going to have to spending so much money on streaming different services that it's going to be like it was before with cable. And people are going to have to make tough choices. And right now, DC would be on the outside because, you know, I look at it as – and granted, I come at it from a little bit of – because I'm a wrestling fan. And I look at the WWE Network, which I'll admit to you, I haven't watched in 2 weeks probably. But do you think I'm going to let my WWE Network subscription ever expire? Hell no. Because no matter if I go a stretch of weeks without using it, I know that – anything that I want to watch in the history of WWE, with some exceptions, is going to be there. And if it's not there now, they're working on it. And for $10 a month. So yes, a little bit more money than DC, but a metric ton more content that will last me. I could, if we didn't have to work the rest of Nick, we probably would not be able to find the time in the day to watch everything on the WWE Network.
That's absolutely right. And because it showcases – DC Universe took an approach that I didn't like from the get-go with the rotational model, because it was trying to be all things to all people. The WWE Network is providing one product. It is the undisputed best at providing that product on the face of this planet. Marvel Unlimited focuses on providing one product. And I don't care what you say, there is no greater value in comics than Marvel Unlimited. It is unprecedented. DC Universe wanted to be this little snapshot of everything across the DC landscape, and as a result of trying to be all things to all people, it is nothing to no one. I'm just thinking with it at this point.
Yep. Now, they have time to fix this.
Do they?
They've got, you know, because yeah, I mean, with we're the rumors only in January.
With the rumors of the Warner Brothers streaming service launching, do they really?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that the the behind the scenes machinations of that. Because honestly, all this announcement, this indicated to me, and plus there's already been reports that came out this week that, you know, sources are talking about how the D is really having a hard time finding subscribers for the service. And if this thing goes on, I wouldn't be shocked, Nick, I'll put it this way. I wouldn't be shocked if this thing goes under and is replaced by the Warner Brothers streaming service. And I hate to say that because I was very excited about it. And I think the people working for this thing, but you know, like you said, there's just too many issues, too many, trying to be all things for all people. And again, I don't know that we've ever gotten a full, if there's stuff that isn't on there that can't be put on there, we need to know why. You need to tell your audience, we can't put this up this because it's licensed to somebody else. Because to my eye, it looks like Warner Brothers owns everything from DC with the exception of crossovers. So, you know, I don't know. I just don't get it. It doesn't make sense to me. And I hope that they can fix it. Maybe they can say Legends of Tomorrow. I'll probably renew my subscription. But we'll see what becomes of that. You know, I don't know. There's a lot to unpack there. We'll just have to see where it goes. But while we're talking about the DC Universe app, one of the original series that they're going to be unfurling in the next is Stargirl, based on Geoff Johns, Stars and Stripe series, and his one of his most beloved creations of Stargirl. Well, they cast the role of Stripe, Pat Dugan, the stepfather of Courtney, Stargirl. And that cast is a pretty big announcement here, Nick. Luke Wilson has been cast as Pat Dugan, a.k.a. Stripe, in the live-action series. He was formerly Stripesy, the team partner of Star-Spangled Kid. Pilots a robotic mech suit to fight crime. And Geoff Johns has high praise for Luke Wilson, who we first saw in Bottle Rocket when he was still working in Hollywood. And, yeah, that's a pretty big announcement. I'm excited about it. What do you make of Luke Wilson in this role?
Yeah, it's interesting. Brendan Fraser and Luke Wilson, you have two former big-name Hollywood actors whose star admittedly has faded in recent years, but still, former big names coming on board for this DC service. That's pretty cool. So it shows DC is willing to invest, at least, in these properties. But like you said a few minutes ago, makes you wonder if it's worth it if they're having a hard time finding subscribers to this thing.
Right, which maybe these shows will be folded into the WB app if that ever becomes a reality. Hopefully that won't just be short-lived, because I like Titans and I like I like the look of these other series that are coming out. Well, speaking of series based on comic book properties, my beloved Scarlet Witch from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Scarlet Witch and Vision are going to be getting their own TV series. We've reported that here before. But now, Captain Marvel co-screenwriter Jack Schaefer has signed on as showrunner and writer for the Disney Plus series, The Vision and Scarlet Witch, according to The Hollywood Reporter. Vision will be the co-lead and will be leading the show's title, which is kind of interesting. This would be Schaefer's first television project. However, she's become a hot commodity at Marvel as a writer on a script for the upcoming Black Widow film, as well as Captain Marvel. Paul Bettany and Elizabeth Olsen are expected but not confirmed to be reprising their roles. I'm pretty excited about this. I've enjoyed their dynamic on the big screen since they introduced it in Age of Ultron, and then especially in Civil War, and then Infinity War. So I'm excited about this, and I don't know much about this writer. We'll see with Captain Marvel here in just a few months how it turns out.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm pumped for the show. I'm pumped for this Disney Plus streaming service because it's going to have a lot of original content that I'm excited about. And once we see Captain Marvel, I have a feeling we'll probably be pretty excited, even more excited about this, because if Kevin Feige feels strongly enough about this guy to keep him on after being involved with Captain Marvel, that's probably a pretty good sign. So excited.
You mean this lady?
Lady, guy, whoever.
Well, speaking of Marvel properties, And that's the one area, by the way, the DC Universe, if they're going to keep me, these original series are going to have to deliver, by the way, because We got Doom Patrol coming. We got Stargirl coming. We got Swamp Thing coming. They're going to have to deliver if they want to keep it. Because Disney Plus is bringing it with their shows, it looks like.
But is one original series a quarter enough?
I don't know. We'll have to see. Sony, of course, is riding the wave of the popularity of Into the Spider-Verse. So much so that now Sony is developing animated TV projects based on characters in that film. So the studio is apparently considering various projects for the various Spider-Verse characters to be developed for television. I'm all for this. I want to see a Spider-Ham series.
Spider-Ham.
I want Spider-Man Noir in particular, if they could get Nick Cage to do it. A lot of potential here, Nick.
Yeah, I'm all in on this. Do three of them. Do like an anime for Penny Parker.
Yes,
do,
about Peni Parker. Yep. Yes.
Peni. You're always going to call it Peni, even though it's a female. Do a Looney Tunes inspired, you know, Spider-Ham show, and do like a ridiculous, you know, over-the-top parody show for Spider-Man Noir. Do all these. I'm for it. I'm here.
As well you should be, because Into the Spider-Verse is not just a hit at the box office, not just a hit with the hard-traveling fanboys, but it's also a critical sensation.
Yes.
Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse just won Best Motion Picture Animated at the 7th Annual Golden Globe Awards. Beat out Incredibles 2, Isle of Dogs, Mirai, and Ralph Breaks the
Internet. It beat out a fucking Wes Anderson film for a Golden Globe. I'm stunned.
That is amazing. Guarantee it won't win the Oscar, but... and it beat out a Pixar movie, Incredibles 2. That's pretty damn impressive for Into the Spider-Verse.
We discussed it from a technical standpoint. If you're looking at it strictly from an animation standpoint, it was a slam dunk. I actually saw Incredibles 2, and I saw – there were a couple other things I think that were nominated that I saw. I didn't see Isle of Dogs. I'm not going to watch Isle of Dogs. However, Wes Anderson can go fuck himself. The point being – the animation, from a technical standpoint, unprecedented. Nothing that's ever been – I've never seen anything like it. Should have been a hands-down consideration just because of the technical aspect. But then when you add on a really engaging story and outstanding characters and voice work, makes sense why this one. Good for Into the Spider-Verse.
And another Sony property that did well at the box office was Venom. Mm-hmm. The prize hit starring Tom Hardy. It is getting a sequel officially. However, turns out they might not be able to get the director back. Mm-hmm. Sony has begun developing this sequel to Venom, and the co-writer of Venom, Kelly Marcel, has been tapped to write it and executive produce it for a significant price. Tom Hardy said his contract includes the option for two sequels. Michelle Williams and, you'll be happy to know, Nick, Woody Harrelson are expected to reprise their roles.
That's all I need. That's all I needed.
Cassidy.
And I want the wig to be bigger. I need the wig to be even bigger than it was in the post-credit scene.
The Hollywood Trade does go on to say, however, that Venom director Ruben Fleischer might not return for the sequel due to his filming Zombieland 2. Mm-hmm. That film began production this month for an October 2019 release. He's also attached to a movie called Jill and the Regional Office is Under Attack. So, getting a sequel, but maybe not getting the director back. Is that a big deal, or are you in as long as the Cletus Cassidy wig is good?
I'm in no matter what at this point, pretty much just because of how excited I am for the potential of a sequel. The one thing that does – that I was looking forward to, though, Ruben Fleischer has a history of working with Woody Harrelson. They worked together on the first Zombieland, which turned out – that partnership turned out really well. And I was excited about seeing him lean more into some of his more over-the-top and comedic tendencies as a filmmaker with Woody Harrelson in the sequel. So – while I don't think that he did a great job of directing the first one, I was more excited to see what he would do with a sequel, just because of that Woody Harrelson partnership. You know, all things considered, I would have to think, though, if the reason he can't do Venom 2 is because of Zombieland 2, then Woody Harrelson also can't do Venom 2 until he finishes Zombieland 2. So why would you just film Venom 2 after Zombieland 2 wraps and wait on both of them at the same time?
Right.
because Woody Harrelson is coming back for Zombieland 2. So you're going to have to – I mean, it's not like you can start next month or anything anyway. I would think just wait both of them, but we'll see what they do.
Well, finally, folks, this week in the world of comics, we may be getting in the future, the distant future, a film based on Stan Lee's favorite creation, The Silver Surfer. And the man that wants to direct it, none other than Anchorman director and writer, Adam. So McKay, whose movie Vice is currently out and getting some awards buzz, has dreamed about making a Silver Surfer movie for a long time. And now, while Marvel has not got access to the Silver Surfer's film rights yet, presumably he will be one of the hundreds of characters that Kevin Feige and Marvel Studios will gain control of with Disney's buyout of 21st Century Fox. McKay has interest in directing a Silver Surfer film, and finally Kevin Feige has now said he's implied anyway that he's willing to talk to McKay about it, that he's excited about the possibility of McKay joining the Marvel Studios. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, even though he's directed all these award-winning films in recent years, serious dramas even, I still think of Adam McKay as the SNL writer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's
or
kind
the
of
Anchorman
interesting
director.
To me. Or the Anchorman director. It's kind of interesting to me to pair him with a character like Surfer that's so based in melodrama and all that. But at the same time, when you look at the critical buzz that his movies have gotten, and Silver Surfer is a character that's never really been explored in his own movie, I like it. I think this could be really cool.
Yeah, I'm down for it. You know, the MCU hasn't really led us astray at this point, and the Fox deal is going to open up all kinds of new avenues for the MCU to explore. So why not go out and get one of the hottest filmmakers out there right now to take on one of the biggest pieces of that acquisition? So I'm all for it.
Well, that's the end of the rundown. That's all we got for you this week, folks. Any news or notes you want us to talk about that we didn't get to this week? Shoot us a topic. Shoot us a tweet at gphillips8652 at nickduke87. Well, I can't help but look over at the plasma clock on the wall over here, and I notice, Nick, there's 1 minute on the clock. Whatever can that mean?
Well, I guess it's time for the wrestling minute.
Time for the wrestling minute. Well, I got a chance to watch a little bit of Wrestle Kingdom 13 on Access TV. Like I watched Cody versus Juice Robinson for the U.S. title, which was a fine and acceptable match, and not very long, but good enough. And then I watched an absolute stone cold classic, the Intercontinental title, the IWGP Intercontinental between Chris Jericho and Tetsuya Naito. I know you haven't seen it yet, Nick, but it was balls to the wall awesome. A fantastic performance from both guys.
Yeah, I haven't got a chance to watch it yet, but I'm looking forward to catching up when I can. And also this week, the official unveiling of All Elite Wrestling and their follow-up to All In, Double or Nothing, that's going to take place in late May from the Las Vegas, Nevada. Chris Jericho confirmed to have signed. Cody, the Young Bucks, Hangpage, Neville, MJF, and Joey Janela all made appearances, so already a pretty decent little stable of roster for this fledgling promotion.
Yes, I'm excited about it. It looks like for wrestling fans, why would you not root for this to succeed? I mean, we need competition.
Well, if you're Jay Hinchy, you're not going to root for it.
Well, sir, Jay Hinchy's not going to root for anything except Monday Night Raw. But the WWE needs competition. That's clear. They need it. And I'm not saying this is going to be instant competition. It's going to be a tough battle. But I like the way they're building their brand. I like the roster together. I like the people that are calling the shots. I think there's a lot of potential there. So that's exciting. Also, I watched Tuesday Night SmackDown this week, and it was very, very good. Continuing to enjoy the Daniel Bryan heel turn. Continuing to enjoy everything that Becky and Charlotte do, and continuing to enjoy the emergence of Mustafa Ali as a major player on WWE's main roster.
Mm-hmm. All good stuff. Well, speaking of All Elite Wrestling, somebody else who's heavily rumored to be involved with the promotion later this year is, of course, WWE author Jim Ross, who is back once again, ladies and gentlemen, to continue our tradition of playing us off with a little musical outro. Now, give you a little background. I was flipping through the channels, and I came across the Lifetime Network. I don't know, Greg, if you've heard about this, but, man, sweeping the world. They've been talking about it at the airports. Surviving R. Kelly. Have you heard about this? Surviving R. Kelly?
I have heard about this, yeah. Nick. I haven't heard many good about Kelly.
No, I haven't either. I watched a little bit of it. He's a despicable human being. We knew this 20 years ago. I don't know why it's being treated like breaking news now. But that's neither here nor there. So I thought, or Mr. Ross and I thought, that what better way to start the fight against R. Kelly? We're actually going to reclaim. We're going to start to take his music away from him. And so what we're going to do here tonight is we're going to provide you with the new, definitive version of one of R. Kelly's greatest hits. So Jim, take it away there.
me. Now, I appreciate that, Duke, as always. And yeah, he is very similar to my favorite entertainer of all time, the Duke, John Wayne. Now, the Duke wouldn't approve of me singing this song, but I'm going to do it anyway because he's dead and he can't do nothing about it. Quite frankly. Now, usually I don't, but go ahead on and break them off with a little preview of the remix. No, I'm not trying to be rude, but hey, pretty girl, I am feeling you. The way that you do the things that you do remind me of my Lexus Q. That's why I'm all up in your grill. You know what you put on your grill? You can put some JR's barbecue sauce. Just slather it across some ribs, put it on some chicken, you can put it on some fish, there's a lot of things you can use it on. Anyway, trying to get you to a hotel, you must be a football coach like Lincoln Riley. Now that's a coach. The way you got me playing the field like Baker Mayfield. So baby, give me that toot toot, leave you that beep beep, running her hands through my fro, bouncing on 24s. While they are saying on the radio, it's the remix to Ignition, hot and fresh out the kitchen. Mama rolling, got every man in here wishing. Sipping on Coke and rum, I'm like, what? I'm drunk. It's the freaking weekend, baby. I'm about to have some fun. Oh, yeah. Bounce, bounce, bounce. Bounce, 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 bounce. Well, now it's just like Murder, She Wrote. Angela Lansbury, she's going to solve a mystery. It's going to be great, quite frankly. At least that's what Lawler says. Once I get you out them clothes, oh, for God's sake, these lyrics. Once I get you out them clothes, huh? Well, that's real cute. Privacy's on the door. But still, they can hear you screaming more. Girl, I'm feeling what you feeling. No more hopping and wishing. I'm about to take my key and stick it in the ignition. So give me that toot toot. Let me give you that beat beat. Running her hands through my afro, bouncing on 24s while they're on the radio. This is the remix edition to Ignition. And a song about pissing. Hot and fresh out the kitchen. Mama rolling that body, got every man in here wishing. On Coke and rum. I'm like, what? I'm so drunk. It is the freaking weekend, baby. I'm about to have me some fun. Crystal popping in the stretch navigator. He got food everywhere, mashed potatoes. As if the party was catered by good old JR's barbecue in Norman, Oklahoma. We got fellas to my left. We have honeys to my right. We bring them both together. We got junkin' all night. Then after the show, it's the after party. After the party, it's the hotel lobby. Around 4, you got to go to Flair's room and clean your lobby. Then head to the room again with Flair and freak somebody. Now, can I get a toot toot? Can I get a beat beat? Hell yeah. Running her hands through my fro, bouncing on 24s. While they're saying on the radio, it's the remix to Ignition, hot and fresh out the kitchen. Mama wrote body, got every man in here wishing, sipping on Coke and rum, and like, so what, I'm drunk. It's the freaking weekend, baby, I'm about to have me some fun. This is the remix to By God Ignition. Hot out of the God, out of the kitchen. Mama rolling that body, got every man in here wishing, sipping on Booger Reds. I'm like, so what, I'm drunk. It's the freaking weekend, baby, I'm about to have me a little bit of fun. Girl in this Jeep, fogging the windows up. Might want to use a defogger on that one. Blasting the radio in the back of my truck, bouncing up and down, stroke it round and round to the remix. We are just thugging out.
Hard traveling fanboys.